Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the head of a watchdog group which has filed complaints against Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker for violations of the Hatch Act that restricts political activities by federal employees. The former senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency, Austin Evers, the founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog and the top freedom of information litigator investigating the Trump administration, joins us. We will discuss the three complaints filed against Whitaker and recent revelations that Whitaker was paid $1.2 million by undisclosed donors for heading up a charity, the Foundation for Accountability and Civic Trust, which had one employee, Whitaker. We'll examine the extent to which Whitaker was groomed by powerful conservative donors like the Koch brothers and championed by the Federalist Society's Leonard Leo to go on TV spouting right-wing pro-Trump and anti-Mueller talking points which got the attention of the nation's chief television watcher, Donald Trump, all the while as head of an organization which existed on paper only that became a lucrative stepping stone for a failed political candidate involved with a patent marketing scam who in a few years rose from a modest law practice in Iowa to the nation's top law enforcement job. Then we'll look into the bombing of a religious gathering celebrating the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad in Kabul, Afghanistan, which killed over 55 people. And we'll speak with Christine Fair, the Provost's Distinguished Professor in Security Studies Program within the Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She is just back from Afghanistan, and we will discuss the escalating attacks on the Afghan army and police and against civilians by the Taliban, and the impact of renewed sanctions against Iran targeting a major customer of Iranian oil, India, given that India is cooperating with Iran to provide access to the Iranian port of Chabahar as an alternative to dependence by landlocked Afghanistan on Pakistan, which supports the Taliban. Then finally, Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to discuss President Trump's craven capitulation to Saudi Arabia's crown prince, whose medieval butchery of a Washington Post journalist has shocked the world, and Trump's disgraceful tweet today thanking Saudi Arabia for low gas prices. We'll assess whether the forces of tyranny, corruption, and kleptocracy, which are at war with global democracy and the rule of law, now have a new champion and leader, America's President Donald Trump. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Austin Evers, the founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog and a top Freedom of Information Act litigator against the Trump administration. He served most recently as senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Austin Evers.
Thanks for having me.
And this morning, American Oversight submitted three complaints, one to the Office of Special Counsel at the Justice Department, alleging potential violations of the Hatch Act, a second at the Office of Government Ethics and the Department of Justice's Ethics Office, alleging failure to disclose. And all of these, of course, are failures on behalf of the Acting Attorney General, Matthew Whitaker, and I take it this is in response to the public release of his financial disclosure forms.
That's right. We are basing our complaints on public filings that Whitaker has made, both in his of his financial disclosures and also based on public filings his political campaign committee filed in connection with expenditures and contributions it received this year, which, bottom line, is public evidence of potential corruption by at the top of the Justice Department.
So is this in any way related to information that's now coming out about this extraordinary amount of money that he was paid by a charity which exists on paper, but there's only one employee, Whitaker, and this charity paid him $1.2 million, and the money came from undisclosed donors who were hiding behind these dark money vehicles. And of course, preceding that, we learned that Whitaker was involved on the board, in fact, of a patent marketing scam operation in Florida where he did promotional videos. And he even not just was involved in a company that was scamming and had to pay a $26 million fine, but also became their enforcer when people complained about being ripped off, using his credentials as a former United States attorney, sort of intimidated the victims of this scam. So this is not necessarily related to any of that. This is a
No, that's what's so striking, is that you just listed a whole litany of almost a resume of concerns, and these two that we filed this morning are new. We're adding to the list of serious concerns about the person who's at the head of the Justice Department right now, and further underscoring the question we should all be asking ourselves is, why did Donald Trump choose this man, who is underqualified and surrounded by a cloud of suspicion, to run the Justice Department when there were Senate-confirmed officials at the Justice Department who could have stepped in, including Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who by statute was the next in line.
So walk us through the complaints. I take it this is to do with the fact that Whitaker's 2014 U.S. Senate campaign, and where he came in, I think he came in fifth or fourth, I'm not sure, but it's been still active going back, of course, from 2014 to the present. So is that the basis?
So there's two pieces, and that's one of them. So he ran in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate in 2014, and has maintained that campaign account until the present day, it looks like. It's been open, but it's been dormant, meaning no activity has occurred in 2015 or 2016 or 2017. And then at the beginning of this year, 2018, all of a sudden, after that period of dormancy, he received four contributions, apparently out of nowhere. Again, he had not gotten contributions the year before that. The only major difference that we can see is that in the intervening time, he became the chief of staff to Jeff Sessions and joined the upper echelon of the Justice Department. And here's why that matters. It's against the law for public officials to accept campaign contributions. It's not like it's frowned upon. It's against the law. It's called the Hatch Act. And the reason we have that law is so that the public can have confidence that their public servants serve their interests, not some hidden agenda or partisan interest or other loyalty. By accepting these donations, he appears to have violated the black letter of the law. There are some technical exceptions that might be available to him, but all the facts that we've seen, including a statement by his campaign treasurer, indicate that those exceptions are not available to him. And then that concern dovetails with the other complaint that we filed, which is distinct. It relates to his financial disclosure forms that he had to file when he joined the Justice Department. When someone joins at a high level at a government agency, we require them to list where they get their money from, where their assets and liabilities are, because it helps the public and the agency suss out potential conflicts of interest. Matthew Whitaker seems to have omitted from his financial disclosure form a nearly $50,000 loan that he made to his campaign in 2014 that is still on the books. That means he is owed that money. And if you remember what I said, there's this exception in the Hatch Act. One of them is he's allowed to collect campaign debt through an agent under the law. Well, is this debt still there? If it is, then maybe he's got this exception under the Hatch Act. If it's not, if he's closed this debt, if he's waived it, then he doesn't have the exception under the Hatch Act. So I know it is complicated, but basically here's the bottom line for the lay audience. It looks like either Matthew Whitaker violated his public disclosure obligations, which can carry a perjury charge, or he violated the Hatch Act with respect to partisan campaign activity while on the public dime, or both. He doesn't really have a way out, and you should expect a little bit more from the head of our Justice Department.
Well, how do you think, though, he got into that position? Because given what I mentioned earlier about these conservative groups unaccountable and with no transparency, funding him with dark money on a sort of charity, if that's the right word, which was a company on paper only, which he was the only employee. That certainly raises suspicions about who's backing him. And then, of course, we learned about his involvement on the board of a patent marketing scam. But then he becomes the chief of staff of Jeff Sessions. And this is the period that you're talking about here, because he was on the federal payroll, and that looks like a potential violation of the Hatch Act. Do we have any idea of how he got to this position? Because it looked like a stepping stone, is it not? I mean, that's what's happened in retrospect, right?
You know, I think the most important lens through which to examine those concerns is how this man was vetted. Because what you have done is you've raised serious questions. The law allows him to have worked for this organization, and the law allows that organization to accept donations. But when you step into a position of public trust, the law, and frankly, just good government principles, demand that we be given an opportunity to ask him, where do your loyalties lie? Who was cutting your checks? Should we have any concerns about that? Maybe it was his mom. Maybe it was the Koch brothers. We don't know. And so you've probably heard concerns that that Matthew Whitaker was not confirmed by the Senate. And this is exactly what people are worried about. He was put into his position by a political appointment with no vetting, apparently, by the White House, let alone the Senate, who can look independently and probe questions. Had he gone through that public vetting process for a job as important as Attorney General, I think he would be given an opportunity to answer some of these important questions and either put us all at ease that he's got no hidden agenda or hidden loyalties, or raise enough concerns that the Senate wouldn't confirm him. This is an end run around the advice and consent process that, while it often looks like a circus in Washington, D.C., is part of the Constitution for a reason.
And again, I'm speaking with Austin Evers, who's the founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog, and the top Freedom of Information Act litigator investigating the Trump administration. He served most recently as senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency Matters. So this raises questions, though, about, in a sense, what is protecting Whitaker. The Republicans, in terms of the House and Senate, have not really acted in terms of their constitutional duties as a separate branch of government to have oversight over the executive branch. The fact that you are the chief Freedom of Information Act litigator investigating the Trump administration suggests to me that you're kind of filling up a void. Is that right?
We often feel that way, and we were founded in 2017 because we felt that this Congress was abdicating its constitutional obligations to conduct oversight, to serve as a check and balance. And today, I think, is as clear an example as you can get. Congress is meant to jealously guard its constitutional prerogative to vet agency appointees, certainly at the level of Attorney General. And yet, you don't even have Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, asking Matt Whitaker in for a hearing, let alone say, I won't support him, he needs to go. But he won't even bring him in for questions. Does he know the answer to the questions you laid out? It doesn't sound like it. What we are standing on, though, and I hope that your listeners get some hope out of this. We are standing on the precipice of an oversight moment. Come January, the House of Representatives changes hands, and that's important not for partisan reasons, but for constitutional ones. The incoming chairman of the Judiciary Committee has made it very clear that he intends to investigate Matthew Whitaker's background, how he came to be appointed Attorney General, whether he's messed around with the Mueller investigation, whether he tried to investigate Hillary Clinton or James Comey. And I mean, those are just fundamental questions that unfortunately need to be asked, but we should all have hope that a little bit of what is broken in our government right now appears to be on the mend.
Well, you just mentioned suing Hillary Clinton and and James Comey, there seems to be evidence that he was involved in, you know, apparently we're just learning today, in fact, that New York Times broke the story that Don McGahn, the White House counsel, was asked by Trump to go ahead and find a way to prosecute Hillary Clinton and James Comey. And apparently the advice that McGahn gave the president was that if you go down that path, you expose yourself to impeachment. So do we know what how much of an enabler Whitaker was, and where was he at this time?
Whitaker appears to have been chief of staff to Jeff Sessions at the time. There were reports before he came to all of our attention that he was the eyes and ears of the White House at the Justice Department. CNN reported, I believe, today that he was involved in some of the discussions about using the power of the Department of Justice to go after political enemies of the president. And so these are... answers we're getting from the press. I think there is much more that needs to be learned. Again, I think Congress needs to get in the game. These are not unfair questions. The person at the top of the Justice Department should be above reproach. And we are every day learning that the guy there now raises real concerns. One of the things that I thought was so striking about that story about the president's efforts to get the Department of Justice to prosecute his political enemies was that his lawyers brought up impeachment. Right? You hear a lot in on cable news and whatnot, people saying don't use the I word. Well, his lawyers brought it up. That's how bad it is. So again, to your listeners, like, think about that when the White House counsel is telling the president, you know, off camera, this is an impeachment kind of thing. That's how seriously people should take this.
Well, we know that Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, spent many, many hours being interviewed by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. I'm not sure. I believe it was something like 32 hours. I'm not sure of the exact amount, but it's a substantial amount of time. What's your sense, since you're a watchdog filling a void, as we mentioned earlier, what's your sense of how much the clock is ticking on special counsel in terms of having a new boss, this fellow who, Whitaker, who appears to have been specifically put in there because he auditioned on television? And we know that President Trump watches television inordinate a number of hours per day and apparently noticed this fellow going on television basically saying that the best way to shut down Mueller is to starve him of funds, and saying the whole thing was a witch hunt and repeating all of Trump's charges, which he levels almost every day. So what's your sense of what kind of jeopardy's going on there? The press is the only people that are revealing what's going on. There's, as you mentioned, there's no oversight coming from the Republicans. Yeah. The Democrats can't do anything until January. Where do you think we stand?
So I think two things. Number one, Bob Mueller is entitled to. He deserves the space to operate. He should not be fighting a rearguard action against the Attorney General. And if anything like that is occurring, it is a major constitutional crisis. I hope it is not taking place. But number two, I also recognize that aside from Donald Trump, Bob Mueller is the most talked about person in Washington, D.C., and yet we've never heard his voice. He has been operating behind the scenes professionally. He's been watching the same TV shows probably as well. He's been preparing for the moment that he crosses some line for the president and the president tries to take action. Maybe that's taken place. We don't know. But I trust Bob Mueller. I trust his team to be prepared for this moment. I think, we should have confidence in the guy who has spent his entire career doing the right thing. And I like to imagine a moment where he and Matthew Whitaker sit across from the table from each other, and Matthew Whitaker realizes how formidable Bob Mueller is. He just sees him in person and says, that is the real deal. And maybe he backed off. So, I don't know. I'm speculating. I trust Bob Mueller. I just hope he's being given the latitude to operate because he's trying to protect us.
Well, just in closing, I'm hearing reports that there will be a whole bunch of indictments coming out at the end of next week. Have you heard any rumors to that effect?
D.C. is awash in rumors to that effect. And so I am not in the indictment prediction game. But I think it's clear, based on the fact that he has not closed up shop, that Mueller is continuing to operate. And again, I trust his process. I trust his team. I trust that he will bring charges where they belong. I trust that he will not bring charges against people that don't deserve it. And if it's next week or next month or sometime in the future, I trust that he'll be doing it at the right time for the right reasons.
Well, Austin Evers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
And thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Austin Evers, who's the founder and executive director of American Oversight, a nonpartisan, nonprofit ethics watchdog, and the top Freedom of Information Act litigator investigating the Trump administration. He served most recently as senior counsel in the State Department for Oversight and Transparency Matters. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the impact of renewed sanctions against Iran targeting a major customer of Iranian oil, India, and how that will affect the Indian cooperation with Iran to provide landlocked Afghanistan with access to the outside world.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
On the chashman maste siyahat maband nazanin azdari ba moye kamand azawal jalwa me kuni sad hazar pas bego jalwa hayat فروشی بچند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who is the Provost Distinguished Professor in Security Studies Program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And there's been a horrendous, not that when these seem to happen almost on a daily basis, bombings, suicide bombings in Afghanistan, but a particularly grisly one took place a couple of days ago, the bombing of a religious gathering celebrating the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad in Kabul, in which at least 55 people have died and many more were injured. There's about 1,000 people in the hall when it was a wedding banquet hall, I believe. You're just back from Afghanistan. When did you get back?
Like 10 days ago, but I know that wedding hall. There's a bunch of wedding halls near the airport, and that's one of the prominent ones. So the reason why they attacked this wedding hall is that this practice of revering the Prophet's birthday is actually considered to be a form of apostasy. And this is a traditional Muslim practice that groups like ISIS have considerable scorn for. And it might sound rather inexplicable, but this is why this particular celebration was targeted. Some of the militant groups that I've studied, Lashkar-e-Taiba, for example, is one of them. They even believe that this practice is an attempt to mimic Christianity in the celebration of the birth of Jesus.
And what about the Saudi Wahhabis, who've had an enormous influence around the world, spreading their version of Islam through their madrasas? Are they also against celebrating the Prophet's birthday?
Well, yeah, I mean, they are too, but the dependent variable is this attack, right? And the Saudis have been spreading this version of Wahhabism for quite some time. And we really haven't seen this kind of attack in Afghanistan. So I think the fact that the Saudis have been propagating this kind of belief system isn't nearly as important as the fact that you've got groups like ISIS. Now, by the way, ISIS in Afghanistan, there's not a lot of evidence or really any evidence at all that ISIS in Afghanistan is tied to the former caliphate in Syria and Iraq. The Islamic State Khorasan province seems to be of a very different kind of franchise. But they do espouse this deeply sectarian ideology, and that sectarian ideology just isn't about Shia or Sunni. It's also about this notion of takfiri, which is the practice of declaring someone, a Muslim, to be an apostate because of the kind of Islam that he or she practices. And this notion of takfiri is really at the heart of Islamic State. We really didn't see the Taliban doing it, and quite frankly, Al-Qaeda didn't do it. This is really an Islamic State phenomenon. And groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, for all of the problems that they cause, and they do cause a lot of problems, they are actually virulently opposed to this takfiri ideology.
So we've spoken a lot over the years, Chris Fair, about Pakistan's perfidious role in Afghanistan and the extent to which all of the American casualties, the dead and the wounded, to some extent, Pakistan is culpable. And lately, of course, President Trump is not talking to the Pakistanis. He's been quite blunt in his language. And apparently, it's offended the new Prime Minister, Imran Khan. What's your reading on what's going on there within Pakistan itself in terms of the new sheriff in town, Donald Trump?
So, of course, Imran Khan is completely irrelevant. I mean, he is not even, as you know, as I like to say, he's not even the mayor of Islamabad. His remit doesn't even travel to Rawalpindi, which is the seat of the power, which is where the army is located. So his views, quite frankly, are, I mean, he's just sort of like a sideshow. The real issue is that Donald Trump doesn't want to lose. And he has put a lot of eggs in the Zalmay Khalilzad basket, that Zalmay is going to be able to pull out some kind of a negotiation with the Taliban. And those of us who have been watching this conflict for a while are not terribly optimistic that this is going to be something that Zalmay Khalilzad is going to be able to pull off. And the reason for it is really quite simple. It was the country that you mentioned, Pakistan. Pakistan, who, for all intents and purposes, drives the Taliban, has no reason to settle for peace when, by the insurgent's definition of victory, which is simply not being defeated, the Taliban are winning.
So this is America's longest war, and it's just going to go on? Is that, what's the end game here?
So I think there isn't really an end game, right? Donald Trump is going to pretty much find himself in the same kind of predicament that Obama was in, which is you can try to pull away your troops. If you pull all the troops out, the Taliban will most likely come back in some more significant way. Right now, depending upon what definitions you're using, the Taliban control a significant part of Afghanistan. And the question will be, is it in our strategic interest to stay in Afghanistan? I think it is in our strategic interest. But we need to find a way that's sustainable. And right now, what we're doing doesn't really seem to be sustainable. And I've come to the belief that Afghanistan needs to think about things differently and maybe take a lesson from India, right, which is on the other side of Pakistan. What India has basically said is that we're going to isolate Pakistan. We are going to develop relationships with every single one of Pakistan's neighbors, including Afghanistan, including Iran, and even China. And we're going to continue to invest in our economy. And this is going to allow us to continue defense modernizing, to continue investing in our human capital. And we know that Pakistanis are going to continue to kill our citizens. But literally in India, about 3 people every 10 minutes are killed in a car accident. That comes to about 170,000 people in 2017 alone. That is more than everyone that has died in all of India's wars with Pakistan's combined, and then you add at least a factor of 10 to it. And in Afghanistan, the situation is a little bit different. In Afghanistan, about 5,500 people were killed in car accidents last year, compared to about 1,000 less that who were killed as a consequence of the conflict. And I say this, you know, not to trivialize either kind of death in another country, but to simply take India as an example, that you can continue to grow, you can continue to invest in your partnerships and really isolate and alienate Pakistan in all fora, even while you are still having an active conflict. And I think that Afghanistan needs to begin thinking along those lines. And Afghanistan already is. It's not the Afghanistan of 2001. Afghanistan has rail connections with Iran, with Tajikistan, as well as Uzbekistan. And whereas when this war began, it was wholly and solely dependent upon Pakistan. But if you look at its import and export data, Afghanistan has really and truly diversified its portfolio. When I met with the president of Afghanistan, he told me very bluntly, we don't even have to import a single kilo of flour from Pakistan. So I think what we need is to think very differently. We need to be thinking about economic solutions that will help Afghanistan increasingly become viable, even while the security solutions really remain a long ways away.
So let's talk about the possible way out, or in fact, the way out has already been shown in as much as there is now a road link between the Indian Ocean port in Iran of Chabahar, all the way up to Afghanistan. And I think the Indians are going to build a rail link as well. So yep. Given the increased isolation of Iran by the Trump administration and the impositions of renewed sanctions, they've given India an exemption. India is one of the main customers for Iranian oil. How does that complicate the situation? Because it seems like the Indians are the only ones that are showing us the way out. Because as you just pointed out, having been dependent, this landlocked country of Afghanistan, having been dependent upon Pakistan for so long, has given Pakistan increased leverage. At the same time, of course, it supports the Taliban and undermines everything the U.S. is trying to do. This is like a big flashing neon sign saying the way out is India.
Well, it's also Iran. I mean, you and I have been discussing this for some time. The administration, I have to say, doesn't really quite understand the perils of a map, that you cannot win a war in Afghanistan if you're singularly dependent upon Pakistan, that he chose to go after Iran largely because of the domestic evangelical constituents, as well as the conservative Jewish vote who really aligns with Israel's interests. I mean, that's really why he went after the Iran nuclear deal. He's really carrying water for Israel with the hope of having political fillip from those two constituents. But very importantly, India not only got a waiver to buy fuel, crude from Iran. More importantly, it's actually gotten a waiver for its work at Chabahar. There are three berths at Chabahar. The Indians are developing one. As you noted, they're also building a rail link that will connect Chabahar to Afghanistan, where they've already built the road that connects this border crossing. In fact, that's actually where I was on this trip. I was in the border town of Zaranj. And this road connects Zaranj, the border crossing, to another town, also in Nimruz province, called Delaram. And that's significant because Delaram is on the ring road. So with this road, you basically are connecting Chabahar to the road that connects all of Afghanistan's major cities, also going north to Uzbekistan as well as Tajikistan, right? So India did get an exemption for this. And I was very surprised. I have been advocating for this exemption. The exemption comes under the legislation that actually calls for the sanctions. And the exemption can be granted if the activity exempted is for Afghan reconstruction. And for several months now, I've actually been making this case. And it's one of those unusual moments when this unorthodox president actually makes the right decision. But I'm really glad that the Trump administration made this decision, because had India not gotten a sanction waiver for its efforts at Chabahar, this economic lifeline really would have been snuffed out. And so I'm glad to see that even this administration understands the wisdom of giving Afghanistan access to another warm water port that will allow it to wean itself off of the warm water ports in Pakistan.
Well, the big new warm water port in Pakistan that the Chinese are building is in Gwadar, which is just to the east of what we're talking about, the Iranian port of Chabahar.
It's about a
hundred and something.
It's about 107 miles. I mean, if you look at the coast is kind of craggy. If it's as a bird flies, it's like 100 miles. But the thing that people do not understand about Gwadar port is that it is not economically viable. There is an extreme water shortage in Balochistan. They're literally bringing water to the port on the back of donkeys. I'm not exaggerating at all. And the water cannot sustain the current inhabitants of the province. They do have desalinization plants, none of which are working. It costs about 6 to 7 times more to move a barrel of crude from Xinjiang, which is the province in China, which sits at the northern head of what's called the Chinese-Pakistan Economic Corridor. I call it I won't tell you what I call it, but it's not good.
Anyway, we don't need to get fined by the FCC.
No. Colonizing Pakistan to enrich China is what I call it. Right. But anyways, to move a barrel of crude from Xinjiang all the way to Gwadar or vice versa is about 6 to 7 times more than what it would cost to move a barrel of crude through an internal what's called ground line of communication in China. So most people who follow South Asia closely do not believe that the port at Gwadar is an economic enterprise. It's really a strategic enterprise. And if you know what China has done in Sri Lanka, what it does, it also had an incredibly overpriced, economically non-viable port. And it rolled up into the price all of the corruption that it took to get the contracts to build the port. And then when Sri Lanka could not service the loans, China said, fine, just give us a 100-year lease on the territory and give us major stakeholding in actually running the port. So basically, China's doing this all throughout the region, and this is allowing China to get basically military ports all throughout. So I think what we might expect to see, for example, in Hambantota, is what we see in Djibouti, where the Chinese have a heavily militarized port presence there. And it's doing this in Myanmar and Chaophyu, where I also was earlier this summer. It's trying to replicate this in Chittagong, which is the port in Bangladesh. And so you see this strategy of China trying to acquire. This is just basic economic colonization. None of these countries are going to be able to pay back these Chinese debts, and in exchange, the Chinese are simply going to ask for land. And so China is acquiring sovereign territory in these countries. And in fact, in Sri Lanka, they're even asking for Chinese forces to actually protect the port, and they're not letting Sri Lankans into this port area, which in principle should have been sovereign Sri Lankan territory. So Gwadar... Yeah,
it's
much more complicated critter than Chabahar is.
Well, I regret that we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
All right. Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is the Provost Distinguished Professor of Security Studies Program within Georgetown University Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and she's the author of Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War, and in their own words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into President Trump's craven capitulation to Saudi Arabia's crown prince.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac. But now that I've got one, gotta send it right back. I can't afford the gas for my brand new limousine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And it's pretty disgraceful that the President of the United States is behaving in such a craven, obsequious way to this crown prince in Saudi Arabia, who the whole world sees as a kind of medieval butcher who murdered and dismembered a Washington Post journalist. Now, obviously, Trump doesn't like journalists. He talks about the press being the enemy of the people. But what's extraordinary about Trump's excuse, for what it's worth, is that he says we've got to maintain ties to Saudi Arabia. But this is not about maintaining ties to Saudi Arabia. This is about maintaining ties to this psychotic thug who acts with impunity.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Obviously, you could have a relationship with the Saudi royal regime or with the government at large that would isolate or distinguish them from this thug, as you put it. He's really one of the most extraordinary characters to emerge in the history of the modern Middle East. This is much worse, it seems to me, and much more blatant, at least, than anything we saw with Saddam Hussein or any of the other dictators. God knows we have had our share. This is really quite blatant, and of course it was very much in our face. But I must say I'm struck in by the reality here that Trump again presents to us, whether we want to see it or not, and you and I and others who have spent careers studying foreign policy and in some cases trying to make it, trying to influence it, I think always held the conviction that deep down this was an important matter for the people of the United States, that it was a vital concern, as it was for a while during the Vietnam War. I think it turns out that was much more a matter of draft protest, and that foreign policy in general, if it's not really influencing, not really taking lives or taking vast amounts of money, not really on the front page, it doesn't occupy that larger part in the American political dialogue. You have here, obviously, opposition in Congress and in the Democratic Party, but you've got 30 or 40 or more percent of the American people still apparently quite solidly behind this absolutely outrageous behavior by an American president toward a foreign tyrant, and literally sanctioning, letting him get away with murder. It makes Donald Trump nothing less than an accomplice, really, after the fact.
But the idea that we are so supine as a nation to Saudi Arabia, I mean, it may have more to do with Trump and his son-in-law Jared's personal business dealings with the Saudi royals. But I remember years ago I was speaking with the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, James Akins. And he might have been there when you were in the National Security Council. This was in the 1970s.
Yes.
And as you recall, in the Yom Kippur War, the Saudi king cut the oil supplies, which shocked the world. And apparently Akins was getting collared by the Saudi royals, who kept saying, "What is this talk of an American military invasion of Saudi Arabia? And Aiken said, I don't know what you're talking about. And then he called up Kissinger, the Secretary of State, and says, what is this talk of the U.S. invading and capturing the Saudi oil fields? And it turned out that it was coming from Kissinger himself, floating this idea. So to my mind, I know, maybe things have changed since the 1970s, but I would have thought if the U.S. could even entertain the idea of invading Saudi Arabia and capturing the oil fields, they're certainly not in a position to be pushed around by this young punk MBS.
No, not at all. And I think that again, as so often with Donald Trump, what's being said and the policy that's being pursued bears no relationship to sanity or to reality. We have much more power with the Saudis and in that region than they do. There's no question that, to some extent, I think this is a function of the old enmity with Iran, and I think in that sense too that it owes something to the influence of the Israelis, who are the quiet element here, the silent partner in some ways in this Trumpian outrage. I think there's no question that the United States has a number of options, and if it wished, if it wanted to, if it could concert responsibly with the rest of the West, that it could force a change in the Saudi regime. They're in flux, they're in turmoil. There's no question that there's the danger of always there of instability and of disruption, not only of the international oil market, but I mean the Saudis, of course, the basic deal there, as you well know, Ian, is the dollar as the currency of international oil, and that's what's kept all of this afloat and what underlies so much of American economic policy in that part of the world. But again, this is just an absolutely inexcusable and outrageous behavior on the part of an American president. And what's so shocking to me is that he will, I think, get away with it. I think he will do it with relative impunity, that this will not be an issue in the 2020 election. I don't think it's an issue with his so-called base. I don't think it's an issue, for that matter, with that many independent voters. I don't think the new Democratic Congress is going to be running for re-election in 2020 with this as one of the arrows in their quiver. I just think it's a very shocking realization that these matters of foreign policy, moral and strategic and vital as they are, really do not brook that large in the American political scene.
But you mentioned Israel, of course. That's an excuse that many, even some of the newspapers and TV networks that are critical of Trump, keep saying, well, you know, maybe he's trying to salvage a Middle East peace deal with Saudi Arabia,
sure,
brokering this deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And obviously, so far, they managed to basically tell the Palestinians to shut up as if they don't exist. But how can this MBS, who now the whole world knows who he is, how could he lead any peace agreement? He has no credibility. So why are people talking about the idea that we've got to be nice to MBS because he's going to help the Israelis come up with a peace deal?
Well, the peace deal, the Palestinian-Israeli peace deal, of course, has the same substance and veracity as the wall across the southern border, or as the invasion, of course, what I call the Madonna and Child invasion there from with the caravan. I mean, it obviously is not a factor. I can't imagine that Kushner has anything remotely resembling a workable peace plan, whatever Nikki Haley and others have said about it. And of course, we have yet to see the slightest detail of any of that. I do think the Israeli factor is large in terms of the general opposition to Iran, the general the mythology and legend here of necessity of enmity with the Iranians, the failure to continue the nuclear deal, despite the fact that the Europeans are obviously going to go ahead with it. The political element here that Trump ran on, of course, is an anti-Iranian, pro-Israeli, very pro-Israeli foreign policy that would, to the extent that they want things to quiet down, to the extent that they don't want the Saudis to be weakened vis-a-vis the Iranians, that it dictates this kind of craven surrender. But these things, as you know, Ian, have long, very long-term consequences and results in terms of the prestige of the country and the interests of the United States in the region. There isn't a single government now that isn't adjusting somewhat its calculus about what the United States can do or will do. That this is a moment, if there was ever a moment, to exercise the influence that we have with the Saudis. If there was ever a moment when they were more vulnerable than they are, as you point out, the world knows who this guy is. This was an outrage in terms of international law, the most commonly accepted norms and standards of international behavior. The Saudis will never again, it seems to me, in a long while, be as vulnerable as they are now with this, and that we're missing this opportunity to moderate in some way the nature of that regime, I think is just absolutely criminal. But it's hardly the only criminal action of this administration.
But surely there are even more lasting and long-term damage in Trump's attitude, because he's sending a signal to the world, and particularly these authoritarian leaders around the world, like Turkey's Erdogan, China's Xi Jinping, Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, Sisi in Egypt, and Putin in Russia. He's basically sending a signal to all of these kleptocrats and authoritarians that when it comes to human rights and killing journalists, America doesn't give a damn.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I think there are these assets in international affairs and national security that are permanently perishable. You can retrieve some of your power position, you can change your trade policies, you can cut new arms deals, you can do all sorts of things to adjust that, but you can't really get back the kind of intangible prestige and the kind of intangible credibility that we once had on issues like this. There was an assumption, however mistaken it may now turn out to be, there was an assumption that the United States, as a bipartisan matter beyond the water's edge, had common ground, common conviction and purpose in pursuing these policies and in standing for human rights and for the norms of international behavior. I think Trump has erased that to the extent that never again can we credibly stand up and say these things without, and this is the danger of it, without being forced into the kind of coercive and really sometimes radical a demonstration of meaning what we say, and that often does, as you well know, lead to boots on the ground, lead to some kind of overt action that we should not have to affect at all. And I think that he's weakened us enormously in terms of this intangible weapon, this intangible strength and arsenal, really, that we had of principle and conviction and credibility of the American word. And all of that, of course, was based on the notion that it wasn't just the Democrats or wasn't just a wing of the Democrats, the left-wing liberals, that it was also the Republican Party, that it was a substantial portion of the American public, it was the media, it was the culture in general that stood behind this. And Donald Trump is demonstrating that the culture and its commitment to those principles has no force, has no strength, has no teeth. There's much that could be done here. The Congress could really make him pay for this outrage. They could punish and penalize and sanction the administration for this. But there is absolutely no sign of doing that. And as I said earlier, what's most disturbing to me is that there's no sign of popular outrage or revolt. This is certainly occupying the punditry in Washington and occupying the editorial pages of the larger newspapers, and will for a while. But I don't see this as creating the kind of a popular groundswell in American politics that will really force any long-term change. And without that, we just don't have what you and I experienced and saw and knew in the America of the Cold War period, the America of the last half of the 20th century. And that's, of course, a cataclysmic change for the long run. We will not be believed anymore.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, it would seem, though, that since the Cold War's over and the new Cold War is nothing like the old Cold War, and in the old Cold War, we all would be dead within 30 minutes, and so we had real enemies and a real possibility of human extinction. Then after the Cold War, the best enemy we could find, or who found us, I guess, although I guess we were the ones who stepped into the hornet's nest in the Middle East, the so-called War on Terror, that's being wrapped up now. The last of the jihadis are being killed in Syria. So the real struggle in the globe seems so clear, and that is between the survival of frail democracies and the rule of law against the encroachment of kleptocratic, dictatorial, oligarchic criminal regimes. And I just ran through a list.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah. is this guy their new leader? Yeah. I mean, could you make the case that the President of the United States, instead of being the champion of democracy and the rule of law, in fact is becoming the de facto leader of the global push towards criminality?
I think that's absolutely true. And whatever happens to him, whatever the Mueller investigation reveals, whatever sanction is brought to bear in American politics, I think much of that damage has already been done. You know, that the battle you're describing against kleptocracy worldwide is waged in 100 different arenas. It's waged by young idealistic prosecutors in developing countries. It's waged by international civil servants who are doing it every day. It's waged by honest law enforcement officers and others, all of whom had thought, I think, that they once had the backing, the support, at least of the United States and of something like a United West. And Trump, of course, has destroyed that much of that unity in the West, and has discredited and destroyed the whole notion of which side America was on. And you're very right. The coming battle, which is a battle, of course, for environmental survival, as well as a battle for geopolitical survival, is the battle of kleptocracy and authoritarianism versus democratic norms. And Donald Trump has severely, seriously weakened the national security, and in some respects, perhaps beyond retrieval.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you for joining us here today, and I, in spite of everything, I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving.
Well, you too, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Laker over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.